KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
One of the things we think needs to happen is that the insurance commissioner's office needs to be diligent about figuring out what an adequate network is, and not just how many doctors do you have, but how many of those doctors actually have openings and are willing to see the patients.
I'll have the summer to enjoy sweet peas, and by golly, there are going to be millions of them. I will tell you right now.
You are a laughingstock. You are a joke. These people are laughing at you. You're nothing. You have no brains, no ability, nothing. I quit.
That was George Costanza quitting his job from the TV show Seinfeld. How did you quit your job? Did you go out meekly, gather up your stuff, walk out the door? Or did you do it with gusto? A little bit later, how did you quit your job? We're going to take your stories. You can email us weekday at KUOW.org right now. Get them lined up. How you quit. Share it with us. Or in a little bit, you can call 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. That'll start about 10:21. But right now, on weekday, on KUOW Seattle, we're going to consider Medicaid expansion and what it means for people who are on Medicaid. Washington State is one of 25 states set to say yes to Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act in 2014. That could mean thousands more Washingtonians will get health insurance provided by the federal government through Medicaid. However, will there be the doctors who will take their cases? Will insurance translate into access? There has been a problem for some Medicaid patients finding doctors, particularly specialists, who will treat them because of Medicaid's notoriously low reimbursement rates. They pay less, some doctors say, than the cost of actually giving the care. Kathy Sterrett is a Kent resident, a Medicaid patient. She's been using Medicaid for her insurance for 19 years, both general and specific treatment. Kathy Sterrett, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So tell me, for general care, for finding a general practitioner, has it been all right?
Well, I haven't had to look for a general practitioner personally because I looked onto Maddie Wiley of Family Care of Kent here, and she's a nurse practitioner. And, I've been with her for over 20 years, and I hang on to her like grim death, believe me, because there's just nobody else in sight here that will accept Medicaid. And I needed a, orthopedic surgeon for my knees. Can't find one. Go through the whole yellow pages under orthopedic surgeons, and from A to Z, none of them is accepting Medicaid. I guess their insurance is too high, and, they don't get any bang for their buck or whatever with Medicaid. So they're just not accepting Medicaid insurance, and neither are any, a lot of the health care providers. I don't know, because, like I said, I've got solid gold, and I've hung on to it. But my dentist, who is like, finding a diamond out in the middle of the desert, if you have a dentist and you're on Medicaid, you are one lucky SOB there. But he refuses to take Medicaid anymore. He treats me for free because it's more expensive for his staff to fill out all the paperwork and submit to Medicaid billing than it is to just go ahead and treat me for free and give me a tax write-off or whatever he does. I don't know, but he's a sainted man.
That's crazy.
Yes. It's cheaper for them, actually, to just go ahead and treat you than to go through the whole routine of filling out all the paperwork and the da-da-da-da-da and the billing and the questioning and the justifying and the da. So they just go ahead and, well, that's my dentist anyway. I do have a caregiver also who is provided by the COPES program, Carol Chen. She's with me, like, on a daily basis, and she's real good. So I do have my holy trinity that, you know, I stick with. I stay with them.
Is that Cope's?
If I go looking for someone else, there is no one else available.
Is that Cope's program a Medicaid-funded program?
I think so. I'm not sure, but it's all, to me, it's all government stuff. But I'll tell you a horror story. I was in the hospital. I had C. diff, which is kind of like, to me, E. coli. And I was weak as a kitten. I couldn't breathe. And I asked them, I begged them to call the ambulance for me. I thought I was dying. I'm like, I can't breathe, help me. And they came in, the hospital, the nursing home administrator, the head nurse there, the supervisor, everybody came in. Oh, no, we can't call an ambulance because then we'll be billed for it. If we call, we have to pay for it. And we can't afford an ambulance call to come here. So they told me to wait for the doctor who was going to come on Monday. This was a Thursday, and I couldn't breathe. So I had to sign a paper saying that I would pay for my own ambulance ride. And I thought, you know, what is it worth to me to save my own life? Okay, I'll pay for this ambulance.
Well, were they worried that under your Medicaid insurance it wouldn't be covered, the ambulance ride?
They would not be reimbursed fully. They would be billed because they were the calling party. It was going to go to their, you know, facility. And so they would receive the bill because I was a patient of theirs. They would receive the bill, so they would have to pay. And they weren't going to get reimbursed from Medicaid for it. So they weren't going to pay it. They didn't want to pay it. So they don't. By the time I got to the hospital, both my lungs were filled with fluid and my heart sac was filled with fluid. And I was drowning.
But then they treated you at the hospital because you're in an emergency room.
If you're lucky enough to get to the hospital. But in nursing homes, you don't get, like in a hospital room, you don't get a telephone by your bedside. You have to rely exclusively on those who are in charge of you. You are at their mercy.
Let me take you back to the orthopedic surgeon for a minute. You went and called every one of these surgeons. None of them would take Medicaid. What did they say to you?
We're just not accepting any new Medicaid patients. Thank you, and goodbye. They hang up. They make short shift of you really quickly. And the thing of it is I just had the experience yesterday of going to the drugstore and having a $147.87 tube of cream approved by Medicaid. They paid for that. And it's like an optional cream. We hope it helps me. But another medication that costs $10.50, they would not pay for. They turned it down. And that is vital to my health and well-being. Okay? Figure it out. I don't know what they're up to. And I really don't have high hopes, because if the government says that 20 million more people across the country are going to be here, well, whoever believes the government, right? They always underestimate.
Well, they may be added, but will they be covered?
No. They're going to go knocking on a lot of empty doors. They're, you know, I really believe that there's going to be long, you know, what we've seen, you know, in other countries, people like soup lines from the Depression or something, you know, searching all over for health care, which, when you need it, there's no substitute. Where are you going to go? You know, a witch doctor? I don't know. Well, you know, that's why everybody's crowding the emergency rooms. They can't find a doctor or anybody to accept them, so they end up sitting in the emergency room. They go there because nothing else is available to them.
Yeah.
No one is accepting. Nobody wants to be reimbursed $10 when they can make $65 for a visit, you know.
Kathy Sterrett, I appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It was fun.
Yes. Kathy Sterrett's a Kent resident, Medicaid patient, and it was fun. Good to talk to her. She's been using Medicaid for her insurance for 19 years. The problem of Medicaid reimbursement rates is longstanding, and as you heard, some Medicaid-qualified patients are having trouble finding specialists. Doctors don't want to take the lower payments Medicaid offers. Some doctors and nurses think expanding the numbers of providers might help, but in the short term, just to begin to address the problem of low Medicaid reimbursement rates, the state agreed to pay primary care physicians the higher Medicaid rate. But doctors haven't seen that money yet. And in terms of specialists, as you've heard, many already are limiting the number of Medicaid patients they will see. According to Nick Ryasich, who's the president of the Washington State Medical Association, it costs a specialist money to see a Medicaid patient.
I think if you're a Medicaid patient and you get seriously sick or get injured and you show up in the ER, you're going to get cared for. I think that Medicaid patients that try to seek care for elective things have a struggle. Let me give you an example. Last year we had a kid, probably 13 years old, with a finger injury that was seen at one of the emergency rooms, I think, north of here, and was referred to go see the orthopedist on call, who didn't take Medicaid and wouldn't see the child, and they called a different office and finally got into their pediatrician later in the week. And anyway, by the time the kid finally got around to getting in to see us, 2 weeks had gone by, and the treatment for that broken finger, which should have been simple, wasn't because of the delay. I mean, that kind of story happens with some frequency. So, yeah, I think particularly for specialty care, Medicaid patients have a hard time sometimes.
What are some of the solutions you see?
Well, it would be lovely if there was a way to see an increase in Medicaid reimbursement. That may not be realistic under the current, you know, economic environment. Most Medicaid patients in Washington now are not covered as a fee-for-service arrangement from the state. In other words, you don't, as a physician, you don't bill the state directly. You bill one of the subcontractors. For example, in our area, it's Molina. Those subcontractors have to have a network of physicians that they've, you know, contracted with to provide the care. And one of the things we think needs to happen is that the insurance commissioner's office needs to be diligent about figuring out what an adequate network is, and not just how many doctors do you have, but how many of those doctors actually have openings and are willing to see the patients. Because, you know, again, you can say we've got 27 specialists or whatever, but if none of them has any free time or none of them is seeing Medicaid patients, then that's useless to the patient. So I think that's the one regulatory side of this that could be effective. And that was probably the main point of our op-ed.
Do you think, Dr. Ryasich, this is something that could be incorporated into the exchange that's being created? Is that information that patients could and should see as well?
The exchange is a little bit different kettle of fish, of course, than Medicaid. But again, the state insurance commissioner, his office oversees whether the plans that are going to offer product through the exchange have adequate physician networks. And we want to see them make sure that that's what happens.
Right, right. We're still left with the question of whether those networks will take Medicaid patients. What do we do about that?
Other than those things, I don't know. many of the counties have started projects. For example, here in Pierce County, and I know in several other counties, there's something called Project Access that takes patients that really need specialty care who are either uninsured or underinsured and helps arrange for someone to see them. A lot of the doctors cooperate with that because it's one thing to do charity care, and that's great, and we all do a fair amount of that, but it's nice when the charity care really needs you. There's just not it's frustrating to see charity patients or underinsured patients or uninsured patients when you don't really have anything to offer them. So if someone, for example, in orthopedics really needs a knee replacement, then Project Access will help get them there.
You know, Dr. Nick Ryasich is president of the Washington State Medical Association. Is this about a shortage of doctors statewide in certain places? Is it about a shortage of doctors at all?
I think it is a shortage of doctors statewide, and most importantly in the eastern part of Washington, in the rural areas. I suspect that the problems will be much more acute there than they will be in Seattle and Tacoma and the big cities.
You wrote in your op-ed, state legislators could help by allowing Medicaid to pay providers a little better to provide incentives for doctors to accept new Medicaid patients. Do you envision that is something that perhaps the state would use state money to add this incentive?
Again, I think that would be a wonderful solution to the problem. Realistically, though, given the budgetary restraints in Olympia, I don't really expect that to happen. The primary care has gotten their boost not because of a state decision, but because of a federal decision.
Right, and of course the state is looking for this Affordable Care Act expansion to relieve it of spending a lot of money through the basic health plan on Washingtonians.
That's true, interestingly, remember that with Medicaid expansion as we go forward, the state eventually assumes part of the cost.
Dr. Nick Ryasich is president of the Washington State Medical Association. He's also an orthopedic surgeon. Is this the moment when doctors and nurses can form a coalition to expand access? I know you have already done that in Washington State, but There is still some tension between what nurses can take on, what doctors can take on.
There is. You know, as a general principle, the WSMA feels that doctors ought to be overseeing what goes on in the healthcare world. And, you know, I recognize and acknowledge that nurse practitioners can practice independently and should, and that's great. And there's no question in my mind anyway that using I don't know, I hate the term mid-levels, and I bet they do too, but using, you know, PAs and nurse practitioners to help expand the availability of care, we're going to see that. We are seeing that.
What do you tell patients now in terms of a year from now when the exchanges are up and running? And what do you tell Medicaid patients, but also all patients, to look for when they start trying to figure out who their doctor should be and where they're going to get insurance?
Well, I think, for Medicaid patients, they're sort of, they get what the state has arranged or what the state subcontractors like Molina have arranged. Patients who purchase insurance through the exchange need to really look at what the network of those plans is like and make sure it's adequate. Just remember that having an insurance card doesn't mean you get access to health care, and the whole idea of making sure that we have adequacy of the networks that are available through the plans that are being offered is kind of the key issues to me.
It's Dr. Nick Ryasich, is the president of the Washington State Medical Association. He's a board-certified orthopedic surgeon who currently operates Tacoma General Hospital and Mary Bridge Children's Hospital and Health Center. So here we have this problem. We have the expansion of the healthcare system with thousands more people qualifying for insurance or having their insurance subsidized or having their insurance completely subsidized by the federal government. We have doctors and some hospitals, some institutions, not willing to take Medicaid patients because of the lower reimbursement rates. The government's trying to figure out some way of increasing those reimbursement rates. But, you know, when we hear all this talk in the Congress about cutting the budget and cutting back on health care costs and rising health care costs, a lot of things that they look at are what money goes out through Medicaid. So, what's another solution, or is there another solution? What are the other concerns? Linda Thiemann is executive director of the Washington Center for Nursing. She also has been writing about this and responded to a Seattle Times op-ed by Dr. Ryasich with her own thoughts. Linda Thiemann, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, happy to talk to you, Steve.
So are there enough APRNs to cope with the expansion next year through the Affordable Health Care Act?
Well, I think Dr. Ryasich characterized this accurately. We know at the state level that we don't have enough of any kind of primary care providers to care for the approximately 300,000 additional people who will be eligible for insurance like we'd like to. We have about, as of February, about 5,400 advanced nurse practitioners in our state, which is a huge increase from the past. In 2004, we only had 3,700. So the schools have ramped up a lot of production. But do we need more? Yes, indeed we do.
How do we get more? And how do we get doctors? Before you answer that, how do we get more nurses? How do we get doctors and nurses to work together more effectively? Doctors need to cede some of their authority. What do nurses need to do?
I think both already see this as a shared problem, frankly. And I think the people that don't want to cede their authority, as you say, and nurses who need to step up, I think those people are at the extreme. I think in the main, physicians and nurses know this is a very serious problem that we all have to share, and that means everybody functioning in different ways.
Do nurses have the same concerns, those nurses that have their practices, do they have the same concerns about taking Medicaid patients as doctors express, or do nurses have lower overhead and therefore can afford it?
Well, I think they have the same concerns about reimbursement. There was a study done last year at the University of Washington about primary care in our state, and I will say that a lower percentage of nurse practitioners said they wouldn't take Medicare than some other providers. They may have lower overhead because their salaries may be lower, but they have the same challenges in terms of insurance, staffing, facilities, running their own business, if that's what they choose to do.
What do you think state legislators should do to assist nurses in meeting this demand?
Well, Well, I think whatever the state can do to support the educational programs in our state to prepare nurse practitioners, and one of the important things that I'm sure Dr. Rysich knows about is a program called the Loan Repayment Program that we had in our state that was discontinued a couple of years ago as the economy really declined. But there's a strong effort to restore that because that provided support for not only nurses but physicians and other healthcare providers to continue their education. Those kinds of things are very important. These are expensive educational programs for nurses and physicians and physician assistants, and we want these to continue.
You know, you wrote, the Medicaid expansion is an opportunity to extend coverage to many more people in Washington, and it can be successful in an environment of coordinated, effective care. What, expand on that notion. What does that mean?
I think the coordination comes, again, from all the players involved looking at the outcome that we want, which is the healthiest Washington we can have. And that does mean perhaps people giving things up, people taking on responsibilities they've never had before within their legal scope. It means full sharing of information. It means everyone focusing on the same outcome, which is about the patients, about the population of our state.
Are you folks having those conversations with the different hospitals and different physician and nurse resource centers so that we're ready here?
I think those conversations are going on across the state. They have been going on for several years. The governor's new senior policy advisor is a physician who's deeply steeped in the medical homework and has led a lot of those conversations. We know that we're not ahead of the curve in terms of the raw numbers of primary care providers when 2014 is just, you know, a very short time away. So it's a work in progress at best.
Linda Thiemann, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Linda Thiemann is Executive Director of the Washington Center for Nursing. We're all going to be doing the healthcare homework in the months ahead. This is Weekday.
#1027. How did you quit your job? 2 weeks' notice with handshakes and hugs and promises to stay in touch? Or did you tell the boss to shove it and storm out? Or something altogether different? Share your story with us right now by calling 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. Stories about how you quit your job in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Compost Days, celebrating the Northwest's accomplishments in composting food and yard waste. Now through April 15th, compost purchasing information and details about The Big Dig are available online at compostdays.com.
51 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. Expect clouds all day with a high of 59. 1028, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Organic gardening advice from our panel of gardening experts just a bit later this hour on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
That's it. This is it. I'm done. Through. It's over. I'm gone. Finished. Over. I will never work for you again. Look at you. You think you're an important man? Is that what you think? You are a laughingstock. You are a joke. These people are laughing at you. You're nothing. You have no brains, no ability, nothing. I quit.
Well, that's how George did it. In this economy, quitting your job, not always the most practical thing to do, but according to some government numbers, every single month, more than 2 million Americans voluntarily quit their jobs. People have a lot of reasons for quitting. Maybe they have a new job they're going to. Maybe they want to move. Maybe it's family, but maybe it's just a terrible work environment. So today, whatever reason, how did you quit? Did you go out in a blaze of glory? Did you tell your boss off in front of the office? Did you go out meekly? Did you write a letter? Fancy Frenchwood is a freelance recruiter living here in Seattle. Her brutally honest resignation letter was the subject of a recent article at Forbes.com and got us thinking about this. Fancy Frenchwood, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
I have to ask, I know you get it all the time. Fancy? Is that your given name?
That is.
Your parents just decided to do that to you from the get-go, huh?
Well, my mom just thought I looked like a fancy pants, So, and then, you know, I have to give a shout out to my husband for the last name. I always tell him I married him because it matched so well with my first name.
It is very nice. It is very nice. All right. Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you answering me. So, what did you do when you were ready to quit your job?
Well, as you characterized, I think I went out in a blaze of glory, and I didn't necessarily intend it to be that way. I really just outlined in a letter, as you also characterized it, as brutally honest. I composed this letter, and I was very thoughtful, and it took me about 2 to 3 days to go back and tweak it and make it say exactly what I wanted it to say. But I do believe I was brutally honest, and I think it was necessary. But I basically just outlined my perception of why I believed this particular organization to be dysfunctional. And so I wrote the letter, and as you stated, it did end up getting published on Forbes.
Yeah. Now, did you hand that letter in and say, I'm resigning here, or what was the process by doing it? What did you do?
So I had been out on sick leave for a couple of days, and I went back into the office, and no one was expecting me to be there, and I reported directly to an AVP, and he walked by my office and was surprised to see me there. So he stepped in, and I, before he had an opportunity to say anything, I informed him that I was here to resign, and I asked him if he would like me to hand him a printed letter, if so I needed to print it, and he said, no problem, just email it to me, I'll print it for your file. And that was really it. He really wasn't interested in anything else. He didn't ask me any further questions. He left my office and said, okay, well, it sounds like you have some things to do.
Well, that doesn't sound as satisfying as I would have thought you might have wanted it to be.
I absolutely wanted to print it and hand it to him. And, you know, as he was leaving my office, I managed a team of recruiters, and he invited me to come into the meeting and say goodbye. And so I did. I left with my dignity intact. I didn't read the letter out loud in the meeting. I would have loved to, however.
You wouldn't have mind of doing that, huh?
Oh, I would have loved to. I really wanted to hand it to him and see the expression on his face and see what his gut response would have been.
So what was the outcome of all this? Did you get any feedback? How did it affect your working career?
Actually, you know, I've gotten tons of, I'd say, an outpouring of support. And you may have noticed on the Forbes article, the comments, the response was overwhelmingly in favor of what I had done. And I think really just because it gave a voice to so many people, I think it resonated with what they would have wanted to do. That being said, I've had no problems. I've had a few offers and people reaching out to me. And I did actually accept an offer for a consulting firm down in California. I'll still be based here in Seattle, working locally, but supporting this California-based firm. And I want to point out that when we got down to the final talks in the negotiation process, I informed one of the owners of the company that I wanted to be, you know, in the spirit of transparency and full disclosure, I wanted him to know that this letter that I'd recently resigned, and I wanted him to know that this letter had been published on Forbes, and I invited him to take a look at it before he sent me the final written offer. And he did. He went out on his own. I didn't have to send him the link or anything. And he called me back, and he kind of chuckled. And it was a really neat response, and that's exactly what I'm looking for, an organization who wants candid feedback, who appreciates someone who communicates very directly and can give them, you know, just honest, professional feedback about what's happening in the organization. And it was for those reasons that he stated that he was excited that I was coming to work for his organization.
Well, that's great. A good outcome. Fancy Frenchwood, I appreciate you sharing the letter, and I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me, Steve.
Thank you. And you can find the letter at Forbes. We have a link to the Forbes information. We also have a link to her own website, fancyfrenchwood.com, living the fancy life. So how did you quit? What was the outcome of you quitting? But how did you do it? How did you do it? 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us weekday at kuow.org. I got a couple of emails to read you, but first, Flora in Seattle, how did you quit your job?
Well, I took my time. I actually, it happened that I was sitting in my office one day and I was looking out the window and I thought to myself, gosh, I'd rather just, you know, get out of here than go into this meeting. And then I realized on the bus on the way home, I was like, I can't do my job anymore. And so I decided that I was going to quit, but because I really honored the work, I took my time about doing it. I gave myself like a week to really think it over, and then finally I said to my boss, you know, I can't do this anymore. There's not enough joy in what I'm doing. And we set up a process together to figure out how long it would take to replace me and do it in a way that was honorable. And that's what I did.
That was good in the end, doing it the honorable way rather than storming out or just not showing up.
Yeah, I wanted to run like I was running from a burning building, but of course that doesn't help anyone.
No, I see. Hey, Flora, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're asking you how you quit your job. We heard how Fancy Frenchwood did it with a letter. We heard how Flora did it with a calm and reasonable process. How did you do it? Here's how Tamara did it. In my late teens, I was working as a shift manager at a fast food restaurant in my hometown. The manager was a slimy little French fry of a man. He seemed to get a lot of pleasure out of rubbing salt into the wounds and trials of his employees. His tone of voice when talking to his teenage employees was at the acidity of a canned pickle. It wasn't unusual to find an employee crying in the break room as though he or she had been cutting onions. Anyway, after a long story short, one night I was running the joint and the manager came in with the new schedule and posted it on the bulletin board. He had scheduled one of my employees the following Saturday, which was the day she had requested off several weeks before in order to attend her sister's wedding. They exchanged words. She cried. Name-calling ensued. Then he fired her. For me, it was the last straw. I was leaving for college shortly anyway. Never wanted to see another fast food restaurant again. It was 8 o'clock on a Friday night. The dining room was packed. I called back Chooch-full orders. That's like a lot of orders, right? Of cheeseburgers, Big Macs, quarter pounders. When they were wrapped in the bin, I slipped into the mall and started distributing them for free around the dining room, making sure every table got a full tray of burgers and food, and then announced to the manager that I quit, walked out the door, much cheering, as you can imagine. I can't imagine that. That's how Tamara quit. Robert is on Vashon Island. Robert, how did you quit?
I worked for an advertising agency on the creative side and for a boss who just could not be satisfied. And so I found another job, and he came into the office, didn't think I was leaving fast enough. So I got up on the front desk in the reception area, and I sang Happy Trails to You before I left, to the applause of everybody at the agency, and then ceremoniously jumped off the desk and walked out the door.
Very nice. Did you sing the entire song, at least the chorus and a verse?
I did. I believe I did. I gave him the whole performance. And he was just flabbergasted and stood there apoplectic, turning red, and then stormed into his office. And as I understood it, he didn't come out for the rest of the day.
How did that end up, that way of quitting, for you?
Just because he came into my office and said I hadn't left fast enough, and I was saying goodbye to some people, and he said he was going to call the police, actually. And I thought, well,
oh my,
might as well go out in a blaze of glory, as you said, and it just spontaneously came. I got up on the desk and delivered a heartfelt version of Happy Trails to You.
Well, I'm sure Roy and Dale were with you on that.
I think they were.
Thanks for that. I appreciate that story.
You're welcome. Thank you. We're
getting your stories of how you quit. Let's get a few more. Our number's 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us weekday at kuow.org. How did Judith quit? Way back in the mid-60s, I worked in a typing pool for the state of Oregon, a terrible, depressing job with lots of personal restrictions, i.e. had to wear a dress, girdle, heels. Using the bathroom was only allowed while on a coffee break or lunch. They would time you. Some of the girls and I went to lunch one Friday at a local restaurant tavern. We were not supposed to drink alcohol on our lunch breaks. I had a sandwich and a beer and never went back to work. Best thing I ever did. I got another job right away with better pay and better atmosphere. And Chris in Burien, how did you quit?
I wrote a resignation letter that I was going to deliver on Monday to the three owners of this company who were really nice guys, but they never should have owned the company. And the Saturday before, had a friend of mine help me clear out all my gear from the shop because what I'd experienced before was the owners immediately escorting whoever was quitting off the property, never to see them again. And so Monday morning came, I got them all in a room and handed them the resume or the resignation. They looked at it, and the first thing they said was, well, can you stay longer than 2 weeks? And I just looked at it and said, no, no way, 2 weeks, that's the date, that's it.
Wow. All right, Chris, thanks a lot.
Everybody else, they would get right out of the building.
Yeah, right. Chris, thanks for that. Here's another email, too. When a man was appointed our division manager, who had maliciously avoided cross-training his coworker to prevent her from gaining the necessary experience to compete for the job, and had left months of account balancing for that same employee to do. I knew it was time to retire. For me, determining whether I had sufficient years of service was a little tough due to maternity leave. So in April 2007, when I'd had it with the incompetence, I gathered up every pay stub showing the hours worked for 27 years, did a spreadsheet totaling the hours of service, brought in the pay stubs to my retirement office. Turns out that I was 2 months past due, which I could retire. I let out a shriek, and everyone in the whole office popped up out of their cubicles to see what the commotion was. For the next 10 weeks, I took vacation, worked at other locations, attended free seminars, had a surgery I'd been putting off, anything that would get me away from the indignation of working for this cruel and incompetent man. One last one. If we may, let's take one last call here. Gene is in Paulsbow. Hi, Gene. Oh, how are you? Oh, Gene, hang on. Let me do something. I made a mistake. There we go. Never trust me with a telephone. Gene in Paulsbow, how did you quit?
My sister and I opened an advertising agency. And so we were partners together, and we brought in a third person. And she was very difficult to work with, and it was terrible. And so I ended up quitting from my sister, which was terrible. But what I did was, and I was also a registered nurse, so I took a travel assignment, and I went to Hawaii. And it was awesome because I met my husband there, and I fell in love, and we married.
Oh, and your sister was at the wedding?
Oh, no, we eloped because we were already in Hawaii, and we thought that was a great place to get married.
Yeah.
But no, my sister and I are great friends. We just had angst against that one person who was terrible, but my sister was angry at her because she felt like she had driven her sister away.
Yeah. And did she stay?
Yes, she did. She stayed. So they had to put up with each other, but I didn't have to put up with them.
Well, that's good. Instead, you got to go to Hawaii and get married.
I did. I fell in love with my husband there, so it was a win-win for me.
That's the way it should be. All right, Gene, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. How you quit. That's just wondering. Better than singing that Johnny Paycheck song, I suppose. This is Weekday.
You're not going anywhere, right, Steve?
I'm not taking this job and shoving it, that's for sure.
Good. That's what we want to hear. 1043, organic gardening advice for free on the radio in a minute.
Hi, this is Patricia Murphy. KUOW's spring membership drive starts April 1st. And you know what gets the momentum going? You. With your pledge of $1,000 or more, you can inspire listeners to call and have their donations matched by your challenge. For details, email majorgifts@kuow.org or call 206-221-2732. Thanks.
Weather-wise, here in Seattle, it's 51 degrees. A lot of clouds all across the Puget Sound region today. Forecast says those clouds are going to stick around. We expect to hit 59 this afternoon. Cloudy overnight, a low of 45, and tomorrow, Wednesday, clouds with a chance of rain and a high of 57.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor gardening supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, Botanicare, Fox Farm, and more. Coming soon, Baker Creek Seeds, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
There are indications today that Supreme Court justices are split on the issue of same-sex marriage. We'll get an update in the news in about 15 minutes.
You know what they need? They need to go out in the garden. They'll be a lot happier. Then they'd be able to make their decisions much more easily. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin Steward, works on habitat restoration, salmon recovery on Vashon and Maury Island. He's also co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Have you filmed? You guys filmed those like 100 years ago, didn't you?
No, we're actually queuing up a couple for the season.
So. Oh, great.
Yeah.
So we can find them.
Yes.
And, of course, the old ones are online.
Yes, they are even on YouTube now.
Oh, that's right. I have watched.
Greg is a YouTube star.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, that's good. Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel. Her book is Landscaping for Privacy. Are you a YouTube star? Do you have any YouTube videos?
I am not a YouTube star yet. Yeah.
You got to get on that.
Yep.
Lisa Taylor is Children's Education Program Manager at Seattle Tilth. YouTube star?
Yes.
I figured as much.
Definitely.
And Yard Talk guest.
And Yard Talk guest.
I think I was in maybe the first episode of
there you go.
Yard Talk.
She's written Your Farm in the City.
That's right.
All right. I have some questions for you. People have some questions that they've emailed, and there are some. You can also call us, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. I have some bare root sea buckthorn plants ready to be planted. When would be the best time to get those in the ground? Is there still a worry of frost?
Plant now.
Yeah. Go for maybe it. Still some frost through mid-April, but it's going to be light. We already had the first day of spring and the first day of snow.
What is a sea buckthorn plant? Sounds very nice.
It's orange. It's got orange berries on it. Hip, H-I-P-P something.
Okay.
There you are.
That's my cue to look that up. I'll look that up for you. Also, second, Hippopharamnoides.
See, there you are.
Exactly.
All right there. I have an empress tree seedling from the Kubota Gardens. Should I plant it, or is it an invasive species?
Well, it is not an invasive species here. I think it does reseed some places, but not here. That's Paulownia. And it has, when it blooms in spring, it has these upright cones of lavender flowers, a little bit like foxglove flowers. And a lot of time, and that's very pretty, and then they form these nuts and fall all over the place. But when a Paulownia is established, a lot of people, especially perhaps with people with small gardens, will cut it back every year so that it grows great big leaves. It's our replacement for all those big tropical-leaved things that we can't grow here. Great big leaves that look like calocasia or, you know, taro.
How do they cut it back? I mean, are they...
They pretend that it isn't a tree and they just... Yeah, cut the trunk back.
And does it send up suckering?
It sends up stems from the trunk, yeah. And then it produces these very big leaves. So you're doing this every year. But you only do that after it's well established.
Weird.
Yeah, doesn't it grow like 4 to 8 feet a year?
Yes.
If it's in a place it really likes.
Yes.
Isn't there one on campus? Very large ones on campus?
Yes, yes. There are. I'm sure there's at least one on campus. I remember one across from the hub, you know, the back side of the hub. But that was many years ago.
Interesting. All right. And then Rico was wondering if you had any advice for limiting the spread of orange crocosmia. You spelled it wrong. Crocosmia and cherry bells, campanula. So he probably means the bluebells, right? Or are they red ones?
Campanula. He might mean the peach leaved.
Or the creeping.
The Crocosmia grows from corms, and it does spread. But they're fairly easy to dig out. So just get your favorite weeder and start reducing the colony.
Well, and the flowers are beautiful. So
they're
one
lovely.
Way
hummingbirds love them.
Yeah, so to keep those cut and bring them in, they're beautiful as a cut flower. And I don't find if I don't cultivate around my Crocosmia, they don't take over. They just kind of...
Oh, okay.
If you
like,
don't cultivate.
So if you don't cultivate, so yeah. You don't upset those little bitty nuts. The corms are tiny.
Or grow it in a container. Yeah. It's always the easy way.
And what with the campanula, I think maybe the same thing is to actively bring the flowers in so that they're not contributing to...
I have the peach leaf campanula, the tall one with the bells, lavender or white. That reseeds all over my garden. And then I think, oh, it's spring. Look, flowers are coming. And then after it blooms, it gets rust. And then I'm very annoyed and I start yanking them out. So,
but they'll have already reseeded again.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, anything to be done about spreading Chinese lantern?
Oh, dear.
Rico also asks.
Yeah. It's one of those plants that you have to be very careful when you dig out and sift through the soil to get all of the – it's probably a stolon or something that zips along underground and comes up.
Wow. All right. Susan is in Lake Forest Park. Hello, Susan. Thanks for calling us. Are you there, Susan?
Hello.
Oh, we lost Susan. It's that number one line, just to share it with you guys. Let's try Paul in Tukwila. How are you, Paul?
Hey, guys. Let's see. A couple things. What I called about initially was about reseeding or planting some new grass in an area that I cultivated this past weekend. Is it too early to put out grass seed, given that it may not germinate? And I have a couple other follow-up things, too, if you don't mind.
Too early for grass?
No, I think...
Good time.
We're heading into... a great time of year. Grass doesn't generally need very warm soil.
Because it's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. What were your follow-ups?
Okay, follow-ups were, let's see, not much success growing Brussels sprouts. They seem to get big and leafy, and I don't get the tight little Brussels sprout heads. I need to know what I need to do to amend that soil to... you know, get a crop of Brussels sprouts as opposed to these big cabbagey-looking things.
Is that a soil issue?
I'm not a Brussels sprout lover, and so I haven't actually grown that brassica. But I think Marty and Greg like Brussels sprouts, so they might have a little more experience.
I love Brussels sprouts, I didn't have great success with them either. And after I tried and have never tried again, I discovered that there are some cultivars that are good to plant in spring and others that are better to plant later in the year. So you might want to read up on the kinds that you want to grow. Territorial Seed Catalog has great descriptions of their offerings.
So you think it might be the cultivar itself, huh?
I would experiment with different cultivars as well. I mean, depending on how established your gardening soil is, you can always improve your garden soil itself, but through, you know, adding some compost if you haven't done that for a while. But as far as I'd experiment with, I mean, there's a, what's that, purple rubine variety. There's a bunch of different cultivars that do really well in the Northwest.
Some people say if the weather was too warm when the heads were formed, the heads will be loose. So you want to make sure that you've planted it at the right time so they're, forming the heads during the coldest weather?
Kind of hard to control that when we have those nice 60-degree days in January. Mm-hmm. Binda Colebrook's book, she just re-released Winter Gardening in the Maritime Northwest. Probably, you know, the definitive book on growing brassicas and other things that like cold weather. That'd be a good place to look for different varieties. And given the Garden Hotline a call, which is a program of Seattle Tilth, 206-633-0224. And they can do some research. And
that was good you brought that out.
Yeah, I have it tattooed on the inside of my eyelid.
Yeah, so that's good.
Yeah.
All right, Paul, thanks for that. I hope that get you started anyway. Susan's in Lake Forest Park. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I have a question for you about a steel bay. I've looked a few places for it and haven't found it, and I'm wondering when that kind of comes into the nurseries.
I would think that nurseries are getting or about to get huge shipments of perennials, and especially the spring and early summer blooming perennials. So your best bet is to go to your local nursery, your favorite place to shop, and ask them. And I'll bet they'll be able to whip out that clipboard and look at their delivery schedule and tell you there are a lot of different kinds of astilbe to grow, and they're lovely. Some of them will take, we usually plant them in kind of part shade protected places, but some of them take more sun than others, and some of them bloom in spring, some in early summer, so they're fabulous plants.
And I'm in Lake Forest Park, so you know.
Shady.
Plants are us.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Well, you know, your local nurseries, you might want to go to Sky or someplace like that and ask them. They'll know.
Okay, I have one other question about impatiens, and that is, my understanding is that you shouldn't plant impatiens until the nights don't get below 50. And last year I waited and waited and waited, and it seemed like I really got them in the ground late. Do you have any advice about that?
Yes, and you're not going to like it. There is a disease on our summer impatiens, which we lean on for color in the shade in the summer. They're just fabulous annuals. There's a downy mildew, and I don't know where it started, but I know last year in England, nurseries didn't even sell it. They wouldn't sell it. And this is like, we all buy impatiens. It's shocking. Now it's here. And so that's something else to ask your local nursery about. They may not even sell it this year, so you're going to have to rely on begonias instead.
Okay. All right. Do you have any recommendation for which, I mean, there's just a jillion kind of begonias.
There are. My favorite kind are the tuberous begonias that hang out of pots and have those flamboyant red or yellow flowers. They just look astounding, and they do take shade, but they're kind of hanging basket begonias, so you can find a range of them. I'd say pick the growth habit that will fit where you want to put them, and then have fun with the color.
Thanks, Susan. Here's a couple of emails here to wrap this. I heard Greg say a while back that he had changed the soil in his potato pots. How important is that? I have some whiskey barrels on a deck that I've grown tomatoes in the last 2 years. Last year, I refreshed the soil, but changing it would be problematic on account of the fact the deck is accessible only by stairs.
Is it
important to get the soil changed?
Well, I was what I might have been referring to is I change. Sometimes I'll change the soil, but sometimes I'll just change what I'm growing in that particular pot. So I don't recall growing potatoes. I did try garlic in a container, and I ended up, it was the first total crop failure I've had of garlic. They got this basal rot that they just turned into these little mush balls. It was
weird.
Disgusting, yeah. Mm-hmm. So no, I'm not going to try and grow garlic or any alliums in the
is that dampness? That is that why something that gets in there?
I'm not sure.
It's exactly.
Fungal. Yeah, there's probably something already in there. So I'm growing leafy greens in there instead, and they're doing just fine. And that can be a cheaper way than necessarily changing your soil out. But it is good to refresh your soil. So I like to add additional compost and organic fertilizer if I'm growing veggies.
But crop rotation, even in containers.
Yes.
And tomatoes.
Especially with tomatoes.
I only go 1 year with my tomato soil.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
I see. All right. I bought a lemon plant last summer fall, brought it back inside when it got a little chilly. Seemed to be doing great, but about a month ago it started losing leaves. Now it's dead. Looks dead. Can the lemon plant survive inside?
Yeah, that's usually where they live during the winter here. And it could be the problem with something like citrus indoors in the winter is that our houses are really, really dry, first of all, and they don't like that. So that certainly could have been a problem.
He said he watered it because he was afraid it was dry, but maybe not enough.
Well, yeah, and so we shouldn't water randomly. We should make sure that the plant needs water. That's and so it could drown or die of thirst. One or the other. They look kind of the same when it happens.
Well, and also bringing it in, you kind of have to do the reverse of hardening off too.
Yeah.
You know, plants aren't in the habit of moving themselves, you know, from one set climate to a drastically different one. So to ease it back inside, just like you would ease it outside, I think is also important because of the temperature and the dryness especially.
And also, just real quick, Dawson's putting in raised beds. Does he need all 20 to 24 inches of these very tall raised beds he's making to be of high-quality soil? Kind of fill in the bases with something less expensive.
24 or gravel. Inches is a, well,
that's
lot
of soil.
soil.
You know, I might fill the bottom with leaves if he had, you know, gravel, deciduous leaves. I wouldn't put gravel in
there.
No, you don't want to mess up. Yeah, I would just stick with the same soil, but, you know, you could fill it with some organic matter that would break down over time, and he could fill, you know, you always add more soil every year. That might cut down on his, the amount he has to bring in.
All right, that's Lisa Taylor. She's with Tilth, Marty Wingate at MartyWingate.com. Greg Rayburn, see him as co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. We'll talk to you guys again. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. You.
This is Weekday. Have a good day.
10:59. There's news out today that consumer confidence is down, and it's down more than expected. That and more of today's big news stories in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from University Congregational United Church of Christ, welcoming all to Easter services at 9 or 11 a.m. Celebration and music with all singing the Hallelujah Chorus. Scores provided across 45th at 16th Northeast or online at universityucc.org.
Well, it's that time of year to be filling out your tax return. How's that going? If you're still working on it and you need a question answered, we might be able to help you. We're going to have a couple of tax experts taking questions today during the noon hour. You can call then and get some advice. Or you can file your question early by calling 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.